Welcome to Rebel Tales. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. If this is the first episode you're listening to, you don't have to listen to the other episodes to make sense of this one. What I try to do is keep the episodes about the stories of those who were there and not so much about the bigger picture at the time, because there are some other great podcasts out there that are doing that and are going really in depth into the overall war in Ireland. But for now, I just want to focus on the stories. And today I'm actually going to leave out a lot of the military detail that's included in some of the accounts that I'll be reading from, just because they're fairly hard to follow if A, you don't know the area, and B, you don't have a map of it all in front of you. And some of it is fairly heavy detail that you can get bogged down in. Today I'll tell the story of the biggest engagement of the War of Independence, and that is the Crossbarry Ambush. To first give you the history book overview, on the 19th of March, 1921, the British forces were rounding up volunteers in the Crossbarry area close to Bandon in West Cork. An ambush took place with about 104 IRA volunteers taking on around 1,200 British forces who were closing in from every side. The IRA engaged them on all fronts and caused the deaths of approximately 10 British troops, with the loss of approximately 4 IRA volunteers. Now, I want to start by saying that some of the numbers involved, well, they've always been disputed, both in number of combatants and in number of casualties. But regardless, the scale is impressive in every retelling of the story. I think the lowest number of British troops that I've read is 350 as opposed to 1,200. Now, based on a lot of the other accounts, I don't think it was that low. But even if it was, they'd still outnumber the IRA 3-1 instead of 12-1. And you know, it's so hard to know what's true from this period of history, or I suppose any period of history, because propaganda on both sides make it very, very difficult to get the facts straight. But that's why I find the stories of those who were there so interesting, because it adds real colour to the stories and it really humanises the tragedies. And I think a lot of these stories are things that historians would overlook because they might be a little bit hard to verify, or they could be impossible to verify, and other reports could conflict them entirely. But that's not to say that they're not true, and in many cases they're very, very interesting. So all we can do is tell the stories, read the stories, hear the stories, and make up our minds based on what we think happened. Because when it was so long ago and everybody that was involved is now dead, we'll never know the truth of it. Just to start, I want to revisit the death of Charlie Hurley, who I spoke about at length in episode 5, which was on the Taurine ambush and Charlie Hurley himself. And I gave a lot of detail there on how he was killed by the British on the morning of the Crossbarry ambush. The column had heard the shots that had killed him when they were laying in wait close by, and they knew it was him. But there's a powerful piece here from Liam Deasy's book Towards Ireland Free, just talking about the funeral of Charlie Hurley. On Monday night, the column marched from Granara to Aheol, and on Tuesday night from Aheol to Clugach to attend the funeral of Charlie Hurley and to ensure that his remains would be interred with full military honours. The funeral procession left Clugach Church in the early hours of Wednesday morning, the 23rd of March, and was led by the local curate to the family burial place. The column acted as guard of honour, and Flor Begley, who had played warlike tunes at Crossbarry a few days previously, now played the dead march. It was a scene to be never forgotten by those present. The flickering lights of swaying lanterns, the slow tramp of the column, the sobbing of bereaved relatives, and the sad notes of the war pipes, all in the dark, chilly hours before the dawn of a morning in March. When the lonely graveyard was reached, the last prayers were recited, and the soldiers' last honours were paid to one of Ireland's most faithful and bravest sons. Slowly and sadly we laid him down, from the field of his fame fresh and gory. We carved not a line, and we raised not a stone, but we left him alone in his glory. Thinking of that there, it's a very poignant scene, and it's something that obviously was burned into the mind of Liam Deasy later in life when he wrote that book. But for him to remember that amidst all of the horror and all of the horrible things that would have happened throughout the War of Independence, the Civil War and so on, for those moments to stand out to him of the details of that funeral. It just speaks volumes to the man that Charlie Hurley must have been. And it's incredible to think that the men of the column said that they knew when they heard the shots that morning that Charlie was gone. And you can only wonder what effect that had had on them. So let's move on to the ambush itself. And I'll start by taking from Tom Barry's account in Guerrilla Days in Ireland. Tom was the commander in charge of this engagement, and I'm not going to read the full chapter, but I'll take out some of the heavier bits. Tom wrote, "On the morning of the 16th of March, information reached us that 300 enemy troops were being sent on the following day from Kinsale to Bandon as reinforcements. That night, the flying column marched to intercept them at Shipple, halfway between Kinsale and Bandon. An hour before dawn on St. Patrick's Day, we occupied ambush positions on the roadside. We lay all day, waiting vainly until 4 o'clock when our scouts, who had been sent to Kinsale to watch the enemy movements, returned. They reported that the enemy had set out as scheduled, travelled over a mile, were then halted and later returned to barracks. Obviously, they were recalled because of information received that our brigade column had moved across their line of march. Incidentally, we were never able to trace their source of information. Immediately, I received this news. The column was withdrawn to retire to Skew, east of Inishannon. 20 minutes later, a British reconnaissance plane, flying low, zoomed along the valley, searching for us as we lay flat and still in extended order, hidden in the dikes, pressed close to the ditches. The following day, we remained in billets, waiting for an enemy move, which I knew was now inevitable. The British would surely attempt a large-scale operation against the column, but we could only attempt to anticipate the tactics that they would employ. It was an uneasy day, and the most stringent security measures were adopted by the flying column. Reports from some of the garrison towns around us, including one brought by Sean McCarthy of Upton, regarding Cork City, that all was exceptionally quiet, did not ease the tension, for such a lull in their activities was unusual and even ominous. It was easy to imagine General Strickland's divisional headquarters staff in the city, 12 miles away, feverishly at work preparing the troop movements which would eventually encircle, compress and destroy our flying column. In an inky darkness, the column moved again northwards to cross the two corked Bandon main roads into Ballyhandle, 6 miles away. Kelleher's section was detailed as the advance guard, with instructions that half of the section was to travel inside both ditches of the road to prevent surprise by British ambushing units. At 1 a.m, the column arrived at John O'Leary's, Ballyhandle, and this house became column headquarters. The son of the house, Paddy, was a member of the column and a captain of the Upton Company, and the daughter was a member of the Cumann na mBan. The column moved off to billet at the surrounding houses. Crowley and Kelleher left to mobilise the local company as an outer ring of unarmed scouts, while DC, a few others and I went into John O'Leary's. I felt so sure that action was imminent that I refused to go to bed and lay down fully dressed on a sofa in a room off the kitchen. Just before 2:30 a.m, Crowley and Kelleher returned hurriedly to report seeing the lights and hearing the noises of lorries some miles to the west. I immediately ordered the assembly of the flying column. 10 minutes later, a similar report was received of enemy movements to the east, and at 2:50, a third report came in of occasional glares of lorry lights and of dogs barking excitedly away to the south. By then, there was no doubt that an extensive operation against the column was in full swing, but it was not until later, of course, that the details were confirmed. At 1 a.m. on the morning of March 19th, 400 British troops left Cork, 200 left Ballincollig, 300 left Kinsale, and 350 left Bandon. Later, 120 auxiliaries left Macroom. Later still, troops left Clannachilty and more left Cork. They proceeded by lorries to 4 points, approximately 4 miles north-northeast, south-southeast and west of Crossbarry. There they dismounted and they formed up in columns. About half of each column then moved on foot as they raided the countryside and converged on Crossbarry. The remainder again mounted the lorries and were moved slowly onwards after the raiding columns. Their tactics were apparently those of motorised infantry, who could be rushed to any point where the IRA were contacted. This arrangement also allowed for the changing over of raiding troops on foot for the fresh men in the lorries. They raided and closely searched every house and outhouse in the countryside. Each column took many civilians and unarmed volunteers prisoner. One of the eastern columns came to the house 3 miles north of Crossbarry, where Commandant Charlie Hurley was recuperating from a bullet wound. They killed him, but he died fighting as he tried to break through. 2 unarmed scouts had been sent on earlier to bring Charlie Hurley down to the column, but had been intercepted on the way and they had been taken prisoner. The column clearly heard the shots that killed him at about 6:30 a.m. Thus, the British made very slow progress as they moved on to where the column was waiting. When the column mobilised at 2:30 a.m, it had full knowledge of the fact that the enemy was moving to attack it from several sides. Although the numbers of the enemy were not then known, the IRA had no doubt that they were outnumbered by at least 10 to 1. I had to decide without delay whether to fight or to retire and attempt to evade action. The decision to fight was made immediately. The column marched off to Crossbarry at 3:30 a.m. and positions were occupied by 4:30 a.m. Crossbarry itself is situated 12 miles southwest of Cork City. It is about 9 miles from Ballincollig, 12 from Kinsale and 8 from Bandon. The old road from Bandon to Cork, which was and is still quite a good road, passes through Crossbarry. Here it is met by 2 roads from the north and 2 from the south, and they form a double crossroads only 30 yards apart. It was west of these crossroads that all our sections were posted. Hale's section was placed at the western entrance to the ambuscade inside the northern ditch on the road. An old boreen ran up this flank, and this was now blocked with a small stone wall to prevent armoured cars from entering and enfilading the column. As well as being able to fire on the enemy immediately in front, this section could also enfilade the approach road. Stretching along east from Hale's direction for several hundred yards inside the northern ditch and in the 2 roadhouse farmhouses, Beasley's and Harrod's, were the riflemen of the section commanded by John Lorden, Mick Crowley, Peter Kearney and Dennis Lorden. This last section on the extreme left was capable of enfilading the approaches to Crossbarry Cross in addition to frontal fire. Just beyond it, around the bend, another stone wall was erected to prevent any enemy lorries from racing through. Between Crowley's and Kearney's, and between Kearney's and Dennis Lorden's sections, 2 observation mines were embedded in the road. The Piper was in the centre of the attacking sections in Harrod's yard, with instructions to play Irish war songs from the first crack of the rifles. Tom Kelleher's section was placed in the castle field, 600 yards directly to the rear of Dennis Lorden's section, to cover the left flank and left rear approaches. Christy O'Connell's section was posted about 200 yards north of the approach road and 600 yards to the west of Hale's section to cover our right flank. From its position, it could also fire on any enemy on the approach road, as well as stemming a flank attack. 3 riflemen were detached from the main attacking sections to patrol a half mile in the rear of our positions. Even though this small group was not strong enough to stop an enemy force of any strength, it would delay them and give the flying column time to change deployment. Thus, 73 officers and men were deployed for an attack, and 31 others were protecting their flank and rear. By 5:30 a.m., all these preparations were completed, and I was perfectly confident that we could not be surprised. After hearing the shots that had killed Charlie Hurley at 6:30 a.m, we waited, immovable and silent. The quietness of the breaking dawn was disturbed only by the sounds of the enemy transports, which crept nearer and nearer. About 8 a.m, a long line of lorries carrying troops came slowly on past O'Connell's flanking sections and into our main ambush positions. 12 lorries were between Crowley's sections in the centre and O'Connell's flankers, but many more stretched back along the road. Liam Deasy and I flattened against the ditch as the leading lorry came on, but suddenly it halted and the soldiers started shouting, for unfortunately, despite our strictest orders, a volunteer had shown himself at a raised barn door and was seen by many of the British. The British started to scramble from their lorries, but the order to fire was given, and Crowley's section opened up at them. Immediately, John Lorden's and Hale's sections also attacked the enemy nearest to them, and away in our flank, Christy O'Connell's men blazed at the enemy on the road below. Begley played martial airs on his war pipes as four of our sections attacked. Volley after volley was fired, mostly at ranges from 5 to 10 yards, at those British. Volley after volley was fired, mostly at ranges from 5 to 10 yards, at those British, and they broke and scattered, leaving their dead and a fair amount of arms and their lorries behind them. The survivors had scrambled over the southern ditch of the road and were running, panic-stricken, towards the south. Three of our sections were ordered out onto the road to follow them up. Using rapid fire, they chased the enemy, who lost many men. These British troops did not stop running until they reached the main Cork to Bandon road, a mile and a half away. Even then, they did not attempt to reform, but straggled back in disorganised groups to Bandon, nearly 7 miles away. Within 10 minutes of the opening of our attack, we had smashed the British encircling lines wide open. We could have marched away to the south without fear of interference had I wished to do so, but now confidence in ourselves to meet the attacks we knew were coming from other British units was mixed with contempt for our enemy's fighting ability. The sections were ordered back to collect the arms of the British dead. Helping them now was a man named White of Newcestone, who, although not a volunteer, had been arrested that morning and carried as a hostage in the leading lorry. He had a doubly lucky escape from death, as after escaping our first volley, he was nearly shot dead when I came onto the road, before he shouted that he was an Irishman and a prisoner of the British. Now he was staggering under the load of a new British Lewis gun and 8 fully loaded pens, which the enemy machine gunners dead on the road never had a chance of using. The captured rifles were slung across the backs of volunteers, and the captured ammunition was distributed immediately amongst all of our riflemen. It was a welcome addition to half-empty bandoliers. Then the lorries were prepared for burning, and the British dead pulled away from their vicinity. The first 3 were burned when heavy rifle fire broke out on our left flank, and all volunteers were ordered back to their original action stations. Another British column of about 200 had advanced from the southeast. They were attacked by Dennis Lorden's section. Kearney's men were moved up to reinforce Lorden's, and after heavy fighting, the enemy retreated, leaving a number of dead. This unit was not seen again on that day. Those troops too, like those on the lorries, had evidently had enough. We had not long to await the third phase of the engagement, for shortly afterwards, the sounds of rifle fire came from the right flank. Hereabout, a platoon of British tried to come in across country, but were met by O'Connell's section. This party had apparently been left behind the main British column to complete the raids. O'Connell's riflemen surprised them, and the British hurriedly withdrew. The firing had died down so quickly that a reinforcing section which had started out was recalled. 10 minutes later, the fourth development of the action opened. Still another British column came in on our left rear. Numbering about 200, they had entered an old boreen about a mile back, and keeping close to the ditch as they crept in, they were unobserved for some time. Their manoeuvre did not, as they had hoped, bring them in on the rear of the unsuspecting flying column, as when they emerged onto the castle field, Kelleher's riflemen were waiting for them. Kelleher's section allowed them to come within 50 yards of his position before opening fire and knocking over a number of them. The remainder hurriedly retired to cover from where they continued to engage our men. Immediately as this action started, I sent Jim Spud Murphy and 11 riflemen to reinforce Kelleher. Spud had his arm in a sling, the result of a bullet wound received a few weeks previously in a fight with the British, but he was such a fine fighter and section commander that I had no hesitation in detailing him for the job. There were now 26 officers and men facing this British column, and our line was extended northwards to counter an anticipated enemy flanking movement. This soon came, and again the enemy was met with such heavy fire that they hurriedly retreated once more. The fighting had gone on here for about 10 minutes, and as there were no British in sight anywhere but those being attacked by Kelleher and Murphy, I move the whole column flying back, except O'Connell's section, to strike at this enemy unit with our full strength. But when I reached Keller's position, all the British had gone, and we saw no more of those either. British corpses were strewn on the Crossbarry Road. In the fields south of it, in front of Dennis Lordan's section, near Christy O'Connell's section, and now here were several more of them lying around Keller's position. But we too had not escaped unscathed. Three of our soldiers lay dead, and several others were wounded. Volunteer Peter Monaghan, volunteer Jeremiah O'Leary from Leppe, and volunteer Con Daly from Ballinasgarty had died fighting for Ireland that morning. We laid our three dead comrades close together in a field, and, placing the most seriously wounded, Dan Corcoran of Noosestown and Jim Crowley of Kilbritton, in our midst, moved back to the old boreen which flanked Hale's section, and Christy O'Connell's flankers were drawn in. About 2 hours had elapsed since the opening of the fight. We were in possession of the countryside. No British were visible, and our task was completed. The whole column was drawn up in lines of sections and told they had done well. Those British units were finished, but other fresh troops might be encountered as we retired the billets at Grand. These were 14 miles due west of Crossbarry, but 20 miles as we would have to travel. Flankers would have to travel cross-country for at least 12 miles, where we would halt to look for our breakfast. Strict march discipline would have to be observed, but the column would move at an easy pace so that it would be fresh and fit to fight again at any stage of our retirement. Shortly after the order to march was given, we spied a gathering of British soldiers away in the distance, evidently groups of disorganised units. They appeared to be leaderless as they were standing around in the centre of a small field on the sloping hillside east of Crossbarry. Through field glasses, I could see them gesticulating as if they were arguing as what to do next. We helped them to make up their minds, for although the distance was a bit far, the column was halted and deployed along a ditch. The range was given, and three volleys from nearly 100 rifles was fired at them. A few staggered and fell, others broke in all directions, and soon the West Cork hillside was clear of the khaki-clad troops. Crossbarry was over. So that really is an incredible story that may have been difficult to follow in some parts, but I think that it was important to tell it like that because it gave a full, simple picture of the scale of the engagement and the risk and how well Tom Barry had it all covered. And what's really incredible is it really could have gone the other way. And if you look at the odds, it probably should have. It really was just ordinary men outnumbered by at least 10 to 12 to 1 by heavily armed soldiers. And they were well equipped with vehicles and provisions, yet the victory was on the side of the volunteers. That story was reported all over the world, and it really was a major win for the IRA, both militarily and for propaganda. The story of how the British knew to cordon off that area and focused their search is a sad one, and it involves one of their own giving information to the British. Sean McCarthy, then an intelligence officer in Cork and later multiple time mayor of Cork and multiple time president of GAA, he wrote a letter to Liam Deasy. "Did you ever hear of the eve of Crossbarry? I was going along Patrick Street in Cork when Father Ned Fitzgerald, now canon in Bannonlock, son of Sir Edward, approached me and said, 'Senior officers in Cork barracks were seen going in with maps into blank's cell today, and it bodes no good. I think the boys should be told.'" And this is actually backed up by Flor Begley's testimony, his witness statement. He wrote, "Another point I would like to make in the interests of historical accuracy is that the British operation that morning of the 19th of March 1921 was as a result of information which they had got from a captured IRA man who had been the company captain of the Knockavilla or the Crossbound Company a month earlier. This man was captured or surrendered voluntarily whilst armed with a rifle at the scene of the ambush of the train at Upton Railway Station. It was an unfortunate business for the man concerned and for the safety of many, many IRA men. The column could have been wiped out as a result of this man's betrayal of many vital facts relating to brigade headquarters and the movements of senior brigade officers. The man in question was tried by the British. He is court-martialed on a charge of being in possession of a rifle on the scene of the ambush, namely, being in the attack on the train at the Upton station on the morning of the 16th of February 1921. He was a wanted man by the British before this, and he was not available to the IRA to fulfil his obligations as a company captain for months prior to the Upton affair. In fact, I was dumbfounded when we mobilised at or near Upton Station on the morning of the 16th when I saw him present as one who was to participate in this train attack. At any rate, the circumstances of his arrest on the scene of the ambush were investigated by the Brigade OC Charlie Hurley, who happened to be in charge of the attack and who was wounded on the job. It was discovered that this man threw his rifle under the stairs of the house he occupied near the station and never fired a shot, but remained there to be arrested. As I have said, he was court-martialed by the British, but he was never sentenced, but merely interned in Bear Island after having been in Cork for a time. Within a week of the arrest of this one-time company captain, we were tipped off by a friendly RAC sergeant to be careful, as he had given the game away, meaning that he had talked quite a lot. At the general release of prisoners from internment camps late in 1921, this gentleman company captain approached a local IRA man on his arrival home and volunteered a statement of what occurred after his arrest at Upton, and he clearly stated that he gave certain information whilst under the influence of drugs, etc., etc. He was later court-martialed by senior IRA officers and sentenced to death, subject to GHQ sanction. Sentence was commuted to exile for life, it being truce times. Now, it was undoubtedly as a result of this man's information that the British happened by accident to come in contact with the column at Crossbarry. And that was from Flora Begley, who was the piper of Crossbarry, but he also fought in ambushes, including the Upton ambush. But it must have been haunting to hear the war pipes play that morning along the quiet hills and roads of Crossbarry. And I suppose they wouldn't have been quiet because there would have been gun and rifle fire for a lot of it. But the idea to play the bagpipes came from Tom Barry, because he wanted to give the British the impression that they were facing a much larger force than they actually were, that they were taking on an army that had their own piper. And this must have really affected the morale of the British too. No, sadly, this Crossbarry ambush led to further loss of life. And one story in particular that stands out is that of Peter Monaghan. And that's not his real name, by the way. They never knew it. But he was a Scottish soldier who deserted the British Army and was found by the IRA. Now, he was with another guy and they were about to be, or they could have been executed, but during interview, it was revealed that he was an expert in explosives. So I think Liam Deasy and the other officers decided to use his expertise to build mines that they needed to break into RAC barracks. And they had very bad luck with mines up to that date. Now, there were many accusations against him of being a spy, and accusations that a lot of the mines that he supposedly worked on, they never went off. But we have to keep in mind that he died fighting for Ireland in the end. Liam Deasy had the following to say about the deaths in Crossbarry, but with particular reference to Peter Monaghan. Besides the sad news of Charlie Hurley's death in action, Dick Barrett informed me that the bodies of Jeremiah O'Leary, Con Daly and Peter Monaghan had been taken to the military barracks abandoned. We spoke briefly of the dead men and had a special word to say about Peter Monaghan, the enigmatic soldier who had joined the column in such unusual circumstances nearly 3 months earlier. We never really penetrated the mystery that surrounded him and never even got to know his real name. Nevertheless, from the time we first made his acquaintance till his death at Crossbarry, he had proved himself to be among the bravest of the brave. Only once did he shed any light on his Irish backgrounds, and that was after the first attack on Kilbritton RAC barracks. While resting with his comrades after the withdrawal from the attack, he mentioned that his mother had come from Fermoy and that his real name was similar to that of one of the party he operated with that night. Beyond this, he gave no further information, and his silence was always respected by his companions. At Crossbarry, he performed a last invaluable service to the column by preparing and laying the mine the explosion of which at a crucial moment made possible the withdrawal of his trapped comrades from an encircling ring of enemy forces. With the remains of Jeremiah O'Leary and Con Daly, he was laid to rest in the Republican plot in Bandon Cemetery, and his headstone bears the pseudonym Peter Monaghan, but he will always be better remembered in West Cork as the Unknown Soldier, and he will always hold his place in the roll of honour of those who died for Ireland. So that shows that Liam Deasy had a great respect for the man, and the way I read it, a great trust of him too, from what he must have seen in action. I think to sum it up, there's a great piece in Meadhe Ryan's book about Tom Barry that really gets to the root of why this ambush was successful. And that's from a quote that Meadhe included from Colonel Michael Joe Costello, who was appointed to that position in the Free State Army at the age of 18 by Michael Collins. It says, and he quotes Napoleon, "In war, it is not the men who count, it is the men." With particular reference to Crossbarry, Colonel Costello wrote, "If the men of Crossbarry had not been led with skill and determination, there would have been no fight to write about. They would simply have been mopped up. If even one step had been neglected, if the leader had been content, as so many of us are prone to be, with something less than absolute thoroughness and attention to every detail in providing for the security of his command, it would have been disastrous. Furthermore, in the superior morale qualities of Barry's column, it is to be found another reason for the result of the action and an object lesson in the truth and importance of Napoleon's remarks. The morale is to the physical as three is to one. Barry's success, Colonel Costello said, was that the men's confidence in their commander, a confidence learned in other fights, and an intense patriotism were foundations of this high morale and discipline." A very fitting tribute. So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and if you did, please consider leaving a rating or a review on whatever platform it is you're listening to it on. And I'll post some more resources over on the Instagram page, which is at Rebel Tales Podcast. So until next time, thank you for listening to another episode of Rebel Tales.